Good evening and welcome to Radioactive Radio. I'm your host, Pat Reilly, and this evening I'm talking with Mr. Carol Orge. Carol is the media officer and convention coordinator for the Astronomical League here in Kansas City. Welcome, Carol. Thanks for coming.
Good evening.
Tonight we're going to talk about the Astronomical League and some of the events that are coming up here real soon, specifically the big event that's on everybody's mind and talking about the eclipse on August the 22nd, I believe.
August 21st of 2018 roughly 1:10 p.m. in Kansas City, the Kansas City area is where it'll be visible. That's when totality begins.
Mark that on the calendar, folks. August the 21st, we're going to have a really neat event here. Like I said, one of those ones that only comes around once in a lifetime. But fortunately, we're going to have another one coming up here real soon in 2024. And we'll talk about that here in just a little bit.
That's right. We would prefer you get out for this one. But 7 years from now, you can also get to it, even though it's not going to be quite as convenient.
Carol, we have some information on the Astronomical League. Tell us a little bit about it.
The Astronomical League is the country's largest group of amateur astronomers. We have currently 17,000 members. We have 300 societies or clubs nationwide. In addition, we have several members at large who are in various countries around the world. And right now we are experimenting with opening up international clubs that will also be part of the Astronomical League.
You say we have about 300 clubs or members at large. What is the difference between the clubs or the members at large? Are the members at large individuals?
Yes, the members at large are individuals. They still have the benefits of being a member of the Astronomical League, which in large measure is the ability to receive certificates and awards for observing certain celestial events, different groups. The club members can still do that, but they have the added advantage of being able to get together for various events in their own home communities that are sponsored by a local organization.
Now, I noticed that the league is broken down into regions. There's about 10 different regions, and I noticed that this Mid-States region includes Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, and northern Oklahoma.
Yes, it does. In fact, just 3 weeks ago, we had our regional meeting for 2017 at Missouri State University in Springfield.
Approximately how many clubs are in that region, do you know?
We have roughly 25 clubs.
How many here in the, I would consider the metropolitan area, are you familiar with?
Yes, we have just the one here in town, which is the Astronomical Society of Kansas City.
I noticed that there's also one in Lawrence.
Yes.
One in Columbia, Missouri. Or actually, I saw a couple down around the St. Louis area, if I'm not mistaken, too.
Correct. There's Eastern Missouri Astronomers and also the St. Louis Astronomical Society. And they are very active in the region as well.
So anybody that has interest in this, there are some clubs here in the metropolitan area and definitely in our listener area.
That is correct. The Astronomical Society of Kansas City is the largest. We have over 300 members, and we meet on the fourth Saturday night of the month at UMKC at Royal Hall in Royal Hall. And we would invite you to come down. In addition to that, we have the Powell Observatory, which is our main location for looking through telescopes. It's located in Lewisburg, Kansas, like I say, in Louis Young Park, north of Lewisburg. And we are open May through October each Saturday night, and we'd encourage you to come down. And, of course, there's a lot of interest this year with the eclipse, but we're talking about other subjects as well, and plus our 30-inch reflecting telescope is the largest in the Midwest, open to the public, so we'd encourage you to come down.
So between Lewisburg and also we were talking a little bit earlier about Warco down at UMKC, if folks are not familiar with it.
Yes, Warco at UMKC is open each Friday night, May through October, and It's a urban telescope, meaning that you can't see the dim fuzzies that we can see when we go further south out in darker skies. However, for the planets and the brighter objects, it's an excellent opportunity, and we invite you to also attend any of those openings on Friday nights.
So it is open to the public. Do they need to call to make arrangements to come down, or?
No, just show up, and there's no admission for Warco. At PAL, we have suggested donation down there.
Great. We have a national convention coming up too, I understand. It's going to be August 18th or 19th through the 22nd, right smack dab in the middle of the eclipse?
That is correct. The week before the eclipse, we are meeting in Casper, Wyoming, which is right on center line for the eclipse. And when we started talking about this 5 years ago, we started brainstorming, thought, wonder if we could pull this off if we had a convention immediately the week before the eclipse began. We've never done anything like that, but wonder if it would work. Well, the first trip to Casper, we met with all the city officials, and it was a real experience to, because that was the point where we really hadn't spread the word that there was going to be an eclipse. So we were meeting with the city officials up there, and so it took a few other meetings to really convince them that there was a big event coming. And one of the reasons we chose Casper is that, first of all, as you go west, the weather is predicted to be much better, open skies. But secondly, it was one of the few locations on center line that had adequate housing. And we have contracted for like 800 rooms in the Casper area. And we've sold out some time ago. In fact, I was just talking to one of our people in Casper yesterday, and the going rate for rooms right now in Casper is $500. It's not unlike even in the area, the Kansas City area. There's some pricey options, but it's free enterprise at its best, I guess.
Yeah, I guess a supply and demand economics.
Exactly.
One term that you just mentioned that is of interest to me, and maybe we can explain it to the folks out there who are listening, centerline. What is centerline in relation to the eclipse?
Yep. And centerline means that that is the place that you have the highest, you have the longest totality. In the Kansas City area, in St. Joe, Missouri, it's about 2 minutes and 40 seconds. So if we go just north of the river, just barely north of the river, you might get a minute or so. You still are going to be able to experience totality. And there is a mystique in many circles about being on the exact center line. However, if you're any place within that 70-mile wide line, you're going to see totality. You just don't see quite the ultimate. But totality is totality. So even if you see a minute of it, enjoy it to the fullest.
So that totality is the complete blockage of the sun, and it's the amount of time that we're able to view the blockage.
That's exactly right.
Okay. The best place to view, you say, obviously, is a little bit north of the Missouri River, or in northern Missouri, as far as we are concerned, or closest to the metropolitan area. That's going to give us the best as far as totality in about a minute.
That is correct. South of the river, you won't see, you'll see a partial, but you won't see totality at all.
Now, does the Kansas City Society, do you have anything specifically planned or a particular area for viewing totality?
The Kansas City Club is going to be helping out with the Sat Joe event. There's a major event at Rosecrans Airport, which will be having some presentations and that sort of thing. In addition, we have reserved some space at Smithville Lake for people who want to pull in there, set up their RVs, and so we've allocated some space there as well.
Okay. And that will be the date up on the 21st.
That is correct. And one of the things we're encouraging people, if you have an opportunity, do not wait until an hour before the eclipse starts to find out where you're going to be viewing it from, because we don't want to scare anyone, but there may be a little bit of extra traffic to see it. You don't have to be where there's 100,000 people to see it. Just get north of the river within the path. You can just pull off the side of the road, pull off on a country road, and you'll be just fine.
What kind of safety issues should folks be concerned about when viewing Total?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because you really need to not look at the sun without some kind of protection for an extended period of time. So we have special eclipse glasses. If you don't have access to eclipse glasses, then number 14 welder's glasses and above are suitable as well. But during the partial part of the eclipse, that is before the total coverage, you do need to have your eclipse glasses on or some kind of safety. During the total eclipse, that's the time that you can take your protection off and look at it and see the majesty, which will include a few planets and all sorts of things that you don't normally see. Be three or four planets, there'll be some stars, and it's a different experience during totality.
So it will be that dark?
Yes, it will. It'll be probably like dusk. Although each eclipse is a little bit different as far as how dark it gets, but most of the time it will be like dusk. And it's sort of it's quite an experience. You can read about eclipses all you want to till you experience one. There's nothing like it. For example, I once saw one on the island of Aruba. There are trade winds blowing all the time on Aruba during totality and during the eclipse. It was totally still. And of course, the city lights come on. In the rural areas where there's chickens out, the chickens go into roost. Just all kinds of stuff like that. So it's quite a majestic situation. Some even say it's a spiritual event for them, because people who observe it react in many different ways.
When I was a kid, I remember viewing some eclipses, and we used to do the old hole in the piece of cardboard against the piece of paper. That's still acceptable.
And that works just fine if you absolutely cannot find eclipse glasses. And I know I've personally been involved with providing lots of eclipse glasses. I'll put in just a brief plug for NASA. NASA's been great as far as providing some eclipse glasses, but they're all over. I would tell you, though, that many vendors are placing their last orders for eclipse glasses, so you should get them. I'll put in a little plug for the Astronomical League in saying that, yes, we still have some still available as well for purchase.
The eclipse is essentially going to run from west coast to east coast and slicing essentially across the middle of the United States. Tell us a little bit about when it's going to hit the coast, how it's going to work its way through, what we might be looking at time-wise here in the Kansas City metro area.
The shadow reaches Oregon about 10:15 a.m. Pacific Coast time, which would translate to be about 11:15. And it will be it takes about 100 minutes for it to reach from coast to coast as far as the shadow of the moon. So
starting roughly 11:15 here?
Yeah, 11:15 here, and then about 1:10, and this will vary a little bit by a few minutes. About 1:10, totality begins.
Okay. And it will last approximately
two minutes and 40 seconds. Okay. It'll vary just a little bit as you go a little further west.
Are you in touch, just out of curiosity, with some of the clubs in the other parts of the country as far as keeping track or, you know, touching base with what's going on there, crowds, you know, that type of thing?
Yes.
And the feedback of how it's looking as a cross?
There is a tremendous response to this. For example, in St. Louis, even though St. Louis is not exactly in the center line, but the general area is on the line, they had an expo about 3 weeks ago, and they had 100,000 people show up for it. There's so much interest there. Hopkinsville, Kentucky, for example, is considered, and they're branding themselves as the place to be. it's a town of about, I believe, 30,000, and they are expecting well over 100,000 people. Similar stories are coming. Our place that we're setting up in Casper, we're estimating that Casper will at least double its population of 60,000 on that day. Hotels are sold out. RV parks have a few openings I've noticed lately from personal people looking for them. But there's an outpouring of support. The city and national parks, state parks, are all doing things. So all over the country, it's a very big situation. I was in a NASA conference at Goddard Space back about a year ago. That working group was dealing with people across the country as far as the crowds, having people available as resource people. And just an aside here, one of the interesting things NASA's doing, they're releasing balloons during the eclipse on the whole path of the eclipse, including Casper is going to be one of the locations. And they're doing a lot of scientific research based on this. So there's a lot of science to be gained. In addition, Google is one of the players that is providing eclipse glasses in conjunction with NASA. And one of the projects they're involved in is asking photographers along the path to take pictures of the eclipse with the proper filtering for safety and so on across the path, and then they're going to put a video together after they get all the clips from the people across the path. It should be very, very neat.
That'd be interesting. One of my websites that I subscribe to daily is the NASA JPL, so I get a lot of pictures not only from the Hubble and everything, but that I'm going to look forward to that. There should be some pretty interesting pictures. Getting back really quickly to the league itself, I think we're going to pique some interest on this, especially with the eclipse and everything else that's going to be associated with it. How does one get involved with the league?
Well, with the league, usually we go to individual clubs, and most, I would say, a great majority of the clubs across the country are league members. They have to pay a token amount of dues to that organization in order to maintain their membership. One of the big selling points is being able to observe celestial objects, certain lists, and get the recognition by being a league membership.
Well, I noticed, like I was talking a little bit earlier about the 10 regions, each region is kind of autonomous from what I gather, and each region has its own director and conventions. Since we do stream, and there's a lot of listeners out there across the country that are listening to this program, folks, you can go to the Astronomical League website, and there is a link to the regions.
Yes.
Shows you which states are in that particular region. You can click and find out the clubs that are in your area or in your particular region. So if you have an interest, this might be a way to get involved and start getting a little more active and seeing what's going on out there.
That's exactly right. And our web address is astroleague.org.
Astroleague.org. Okay. Getting ready to wrap up here for the evening. I really appreciate your time. Carol, is there anything else that you would like to add about what's going on with the league or what's coming up in the future?
Well, the one thing I would like to emphasize is for this eclipse, make sure you make a special effort to get out and see it.
And again, we've been talking with Mr. Carol Orge, the media officer and convention coordinator for the Astronomical League. They're located here in Kansas City. Their website, again, is astroleague.org, A-S-T-R-O, league, L-E-A-G-U-E.org.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks, Carol. Yep.
You are listening to Radioactive Magazine.
My guest this evening is Barry Lee. Barry Lee is well known to the listeners here on KKFI for many, many years of wonderful music. And Barry and I have known each other since probably the mid to late 70s when we first met, shortly after high school in those days. So we go back almost 50 years pushing
it. Wow. Yeah.
Like the Grateful Dead said, a little touch of gray kind of suits us anyway.
It does.
but Barry, but, you like I said, you've been with KKFI for...
I started in 86. I went to a community university class, oddly enough, at UMKC. that was basically a recruitment class for KKFI. You know, it was a, hey, let's start a radio station. You want to, you know, you want to be involved? Come to this community class. So I did. I signed up for it. And so I went to the class, and it was a momentous thing because not only did I meet a person who became a good friend of mine, Al Mullen, at that thing, and they recruited me, and I got involved, but it turned out he was married to the woman that I am married to now. So I would not have met her via him had I not gone. So, yeah, long way of saying yes, 32 years. 2 years before we were on the air is when I started.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I got involved through a community class also. Happened to catch one that Bill Klaus was putting on Progressive Radio, Radioactive Radio, which is kind of what I'm getting into here now and enjoying every second of it. One thing that I have noticed about the on-air personalities down here is the love that they put into their program, the music, the talk that they share with the folks out there. Is that something that you find a driving force in your programs and how you feel about it, a little bit of love and sharing the music with the folks?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the whole thing about community radio. That's really what you said is basically the basis of what makes community radio unique, is it's people untrained, for the most part, their own voices, their real voices, doing things, either tackling subjects in a public affairs program or playing music that they absolutely adore and can indulge their passion for whatever it is, you know, be it a news show or a music show. And there's no restrictions other than the FCC restrictions. So people are free to be creative when they do programming here, whatever kind of programming it may be. Nobody is going to be looking over your shoulder going, you can't do that. And that's why community radio is never boring, because it, you know, because it's real life. You know, it's not slick. It's not everything edited down where it all sounds perfect. You know, it's like real people in real time.
Warts and all.
Warts and all, which I like. You know, different voices. You know, like everybody doesn't sound the same here. You know, there are some stations where people are basically programmed to sound a certain way on the air. You know, and you can't be very emotional and you can't get deeply into things and so on. Here it's like everybody's voice is different, but everybody's voice is unique. And the things that they bring to the station, like their programming, whatever it might be, or their volunteer work, is something that is because it's done because they love it. You know, it's done for the passion of it. It's done for the art or whatever their reason is. It's something that fulfills them. You know, and I've been doing this for, God, almost half my life has been involved in community radio. I've never gotten paid for it except when I was manager for 3 years, but never got paid a cent for it, and I didn't care. Because I got to do, nobody's ever told me what to play. You know, in 30 years of being on the air, I can literally play anything I want. And that's cool. I would rather do that than have somebody pay me and tell me what to play. Because I would go, no, I'm not going to, you know, I could use the money, but I'm not going to do that.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed in your programming, and particularly in the programs that you do, in your shows, you have a theme, you know, that you're playing to from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. You know, when you post on Facebook what's coming up on your show this week, yeah, you have the theme that you're patterning.
Yeah, I title them.
Right. And then it seems like each segment, each of your 4 or 5 song segments, will build into the theme, and they will follow each other in mm-hmm. kind of a pattern of not necessarily music, but the theme behind that particular song in the overall theme together.
Yes, you have it.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm doing. And a lot of people don't realize that. I mean, a lot of people just go, oh, that's cool music. You know, they're really, the fact that there's some thought behind it and things are in a certain place because thematically or otherwise mood-wise, you know, they're there for that reason. Most people don't know or care about that stuff. You're one of the very few, you know, maybe a couple of other people that I know, Bill certainly, know exactly what I'm doing with this show, you know, because I'm putting a lot of different elements together. But it is definitely meant as a work, you know, a piece of, you know, a two-part maybe, but it's definitely, to my mind, a whole work, like a poem or a song. You know, it's just got a lot of different songs in it, but it does the same sort of thing that a poem would do. You know, it conveys whatever you want to convey, whether it's political. You know, I've done political shows, thinking about doing another one here pretty soon. Or I've done theme shows, like I, you know, for like the Woodstock anniversary, you know, I did like Woodstock stuff, where I do a night at the Fillmore where I just play nothing but stuff recorded at the Fillmore West or East. So you can do that kind of stuff too. But yeah, you're exactly right. That's exactly what I'm doing. That's, yeah, that's the whole story.
A suggestion for one of the upcoming ones. How about Covfefe?
Yeah. The Covfefe brothers. Covfefe is how I pronounce it. Because it sounds more, I don't know. It just sounds more nincompoopy, you know.
Yeah.
I thought that's in his head. Maybe that's what he was like. Covfefe, you know.
Whatever. Now, sometimes too, you bring in your bride, Caroline, and
yes.
She does some programs too, and put some things together. I remember a blues show that she did here just a little while back, a couple of months ago, and there wasn't too much in the way of contemporary blues in there. She was hitting the Blind Melon Jefferson and, you know, things like that, where the roots really came from. She enjoys doing that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, getting her to do a show is difficult because she's very busy and she agonizes over them even more than I do. But she's taught me a lot. I mean, when I first got with her, I like rock and roll, you know. I mean, I like blues, I like reggae, you know, not so much metal, but, you know, I liked a lot of stuff, jazz. But, you know, country and bluegrass stuff, I just didn't really care. You know, it was like irrelevant to me. I didn't understand it. And she taught me, you know, to enjoy that kind of music. Now I love it. But she, you know, educated me, you know, like she did on that show. It's like, no, Barry, you need to hear these guys. You know, okay, now you heard those guys. Now you need to hear these guys because these guys are influenced by those guys. So I got a whole education into a whole genre, two genres really, that I hadn't really considered to be worthwhile, and found out, holy crap, they are worthwhile. There's some good stuff in every genre, you know. So I finally learned, like, oh, okay, there's other stuff, you know. More open-mindedness is always a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I love working with her. She used to do a show here back. She did the first alt-country show ever, I think, in the U.S. called Watusi Rodeo. It was on in 1980, between 88 and 89. It only lasted a year, and her husband and her did it. And they played stuff like Eugene Chadbourne. They were playing Rank and File, playing early Alejandro Escovedo stuff. I mean, they were playing stuff that now you go to Austin and probably half the stations in town are playing it. But back in the 80s, nobody was playing that stuff. Cowpunk. Mm-hmm. She was into cowpunk. You know, I didn't even know what it was. So, yeah, she always kind of poo-poos her influence here. But to my mind, she was a huge influence, and she was one of the creators of the station, and I never let her forget it, you know, because I came on later. You know, she was here before me.
It has been rumored that your music collection at home would rival the Library of Congress. Because I remember back in our days, you know, we were always hitting the store for 45s and albums. And, you know,
we never bought them new, hardly, right?
Right.
They're always
very
used.
Seldom, yeah. I can remember, what was it, the Atlantic Spartan on 350 Highway out in Raytown. Their record department was right inside the front door.
Yeah.
And that's where everybody congregated. The parents went back and shopped.
Right.
We were in the music shop right inside the front door.
The covers.
When the parents were leaving, they knew, hey, come on, it's time to go.
Right. Yeah, there was a bunch of them around. Remember The Landing? You know, Burstein Appleby? They were a local chain, I do believe, and they had several stores in town that had really good records. Mm-hmm. And I like those too. I mean, of course, I went to, like you and everybody else, went to Capers Corners and, you know, Love Records. And I've still got all those old things with Love Records stickers on them all around. It's shrinking. You know, I used to have, you probably remember being at my house and I had scads and scads of LPs. Now I'm down to just a few hundred. You know, I've sort of whittled them down. Unfortunately, on the other side of it, my CD collection is like somewhere around 25,000 and still growing by leaps and bounds.
Leaps and bounds.
But it's nice to have a library like that where I can literally, if there's something I want to, some direction I want to go musically in a show, I can go to this part of the library and there's all the stuff, you know. So, yeah, it's nice to have, you know, stuff to work with.
How do you catalog all that?
Just alphabetically. Okay. On shelves. You know, if you come down to my house, I've got floor-to-ceiling shelves that actually we inherited with the house. They were bookshelves. And the reason we got the house, short story, is I told him, are you leaving those? Because he was afraid that people wouldn't want them. And when I told him that, he was like, wow, you can buy the house because you're going to respect these shelves that I built myself. So, yeah, there's like 8-7 shelves from floor to ceiling with CDs in them. I'll alphabetize. I keep jazz in a different room, and I keep comps in a separate room, and then my handmade stuff is in a separate room, but the others are basically in the basement where they're all alphabetical. So I can just go pull out the A's or B's or whatever. Great. Makes it easy.
Great.
Yeah. Got to when you got that many.
Well, folks, time to wrap it up. Barry's got a show to do here in just a little while, a little prep put together. But I wanted to thank him very kindly for sitting in and chatting with me this evening and help me out with this this next step in the
project.
In my process and
yes.
My projects. Yes.
Well, you're going to do well. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're with KKFI. It's good to reconnect after all these years, too, and do stuff together. You know, let's do some cool, creative stuff and help people out.
It's nice to reestablish an old friendship.
Oh, obviously, yes. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Barry.